This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Regularly, Governor Daniel Malloy stops by our studios to talk with you, to answer your questions at 860-275-7266. And today is one of those days, just a few days after his State of the State address, where he rolled out some ambitious new plans, talked a little bit about the state of Connecticut, and we're going to be talking with him today. Again, answering your questions at 860-275-7266, talking about the state budget, talking about education, and talking about where we stand right now politically, amongst other things. And we want to welcome you back, Governor Malloy. Thanks so much for being here.
Yeah, it's great to be back. I always enjoy it.
And the cameras of CTN, the Connecticut Network, are here as well. I'm going to start, actually, the same place that my friend Dennis House did the other day. He hosts Face the State on WFSB. The last few times you've been in here with me, I think I've ended the program by asking you kind of offhandedly, have you decided yet whether or not you're running for governor again, for re-election? And you've said, well, that time will come and that decision is going to come down the road. It's now 2014. It is an election year. Some people are lining up against you. Are you going to run for re-election?
Well, I either am or not, and I'll make a decision and an announcement at some point in the future. And I've never hidden that I enjoy the job, and I like the challenge. I'm trying not to talk about politics very much.
I understand. I think one of the reasons that I'm interested in listening to your answer to Dennis the other day, one of the reasons I'm interested in it, I was thinking about if you weren't to run, it would be really hard for another Democrat to get in the race for governor right now. We've got some people already raising money on the Republican side. I know some people have considered this in the past. If you don't run for governor, it would be very hard for the Democrats to put up a legitimate candidate in November.
Well, listen, as I said on that interview, I thought Nancy Wyman would be a great candidate for governor. She's been a great lieutenant governor. She's led the effort that really has brought about the best results under the Obamacare or whatever you want to call it, Access CT. I'm just trying not to talk about politics. I'm trying to talk about government, trying to get the job done. I've been a governor through three very tough years. This year seems to be a little bit better and a little bit easier, and I think we've turned some major corners. So I'd rather dwell in the present as opposed to the future.
Understandable. I think some of the folks on the other side of the aisle, Republicans either who are running for the seat they've already said they are or who aren't, who are just in the legislature, have essentially said that, well, he must be running because some of the things that you've rolled out sound an awful lot like the things governors do in an election year. We'll talk about some of them, but things like a rebate to individuals with a little bit of money that we have in the surplus right now, a rebate of $55 for individuals. Sounds like the sort of thing that happens oftentimes in an election year. That's what we're hearing from your opponents, and so politics is part of the game right now.
Well, that sounds very political on their part, doesn't it?
I suppose it does sound,
yeah,
sound pretty political.
I mean, it does, really. Yeah. I mean, who's playing games here? Yeah. I'm certainly not. It's the first time we've had a very large surplus, $500 million. What else would you do with the money? You give it back to people. You cut taxes. You fund the rainy day fund. You pay down your worst in the nation pension obligations. And by the way, I didn't make them worst in the nation. The other side did. They were sitting in the governor's chair for the better part of 20 years. I know you guys have to do this, but every time they say, look, he's being political, they're being political. They want to be governor. They want to be governor in good times. They say, let Dan Malloy have been the governor who had to handle all the bad times and do the really tough things, and we want to be governor in the good times. Why don't we talk about issues? I like.
But we definitely will. The only reason I'm asking you about this, governor, is you pride yourself on being a straight shooter. You talk an awful lot about wanting to be clear with the people of Connecticut, and this is one thing in which I think it's fairly obvious to people that you are going to run for re-election. And I think a lot of us would like to know, are you going to run again because of all the things that you've said in your State of the State address that you've achieved, the things that you want to achieve? I think many people want to know that the governor who's been here for the last 4 years is going to attempt to be the governor who's going to be here for the next 4 years.
Well, let me be very clear. I never stop thinking about the future in that sense, that if you look at what we have done in the state of Connecticut, it's all about long ball, not short ball. It's all about wiping out $11.6 billion of the state's debt. That's what we've done in the last 3 years. $11.6 billion on the state's sheets has been wiped out. Whether it's investing in housing, investing in infrastructure, investing in companies. I mean, one of my favorite statistics from the address the other day was that, you know, from 2002 to 2010, the state made investments in 118 firms. In the 2 years since the special job session and one program along the EXP, Small Business Express program, we've invested in nearly 1,000 companies. That's long ball. That's not short ball by any stretch of the imagination. Building up small businesses in our state to produce more jobs, retain more jobs, 13,800 total jobs retained and created, that's long ball. It ain't short ball.
We're talking with Governor Daniel Malloy. We're going to get to some of your calls and questions at 860-275-7266 in just a moment. You can also email us questions where we live at WNPR.org. One of the things that you talked about in your State of the State address, but that you'd rolled out a few days before, was your attempt now to raise the minimum wage to $10.10 by January of 2017. This is the same number that the president has been talking about. Now, back in December on our show, I asked you about the minimum wage. Here's what you told me.
There is a reality that the minimum wage has not kept pace with inflation since minimum wages were established, and we should certainly look at moving in an appropriate direction, which is increasing the minimum wage. On the other hand, I'm not sure how far out in front of every other state we have to get. With this increase on January 1st, we'll be, I think, in the top five or six states.
And again, this increase that's already been passed is going to eventually get the minimum wage to $9 by next January. So what changed in the last couple months?
Play back the tape. I said how we get there and the steps we take to get there are very important. I think getting to $10.10 is the appropriate thing to do. We're not the only state going in that direction. I saw an interesting report over the weekend that said if the minimum wage had kept pace with productivity, it would be $18.65. Mm-hmm. If it had kept pace with inflation, it'd be $11.61, if I remember correctly, somewhere in both of those ranges. So the idea that over a three-year period of time, we'll actually get to $10.10, which last time I checked is substantially less than $11.61, we will have done it, I think, in a timely, appropriate manner, taking a step of 45 cents next January 1st, 45 cents the January 1st after that, 50 cents after that. And all of a sudden, people working 40 hours a week in a minimum pay job will at least take home in a gross check, not a net check, $404. I don't think that there's anything outrageous about that. And I think that the plan that we've laid out is an appropriate one. For instance, I would love Washington to go to $10.10 overnight. Because then you have a very level playing field. What I've laid out is a plan to get there over time.
Now, the reason I played that from December is I think I was asking about that $10.10 an hour at that time and whether or not you supported a rise to that level. I guess I'm just wondering if there's some substantial thing that changed in our outlook as a state that would allow us to say now we want to make it $10.10 as opposed to the $9 that we'd already said we're going to do.
Well, $10.10 in 2017. Let's keep talking about it in those terms. And yeah, I think we are turning a corner. I think we have turned a corner in the state of Connecticut. And I think there's a recognition that with all of the expenses that working families have, having a minimum wage that keeps people technically in poverty on a national basis, even though they're working 40 hours a week, makes no sense at all.
I'll just quickly ask you a question about that.
Well, let me point out that with at $10.10,
yeah,
you're not in the poverty. You're not classified as poor in the nation. But until we get to that point, you will be. And so, you know, working 40 hours a week, and by the way, there are working families out there where both mom and dad have minimum salary jobs or minimum hourly jobs. I want to lift those families up. I think it's good for them. It's good for our economy. It's good for their children. And quite frankly, who's against it?
I don't think a whole lot of people are against it. It seems as though nationally people are very much behind this. The only people who seem to be against it are some business owners who say that this will cause them to have to cut jobs, or it presents more uncertainty. And I think that's the thing I wanted to ask you about. It's many businesses say, Governor, it's not so much the level of the minimum wage. It's that we don't know how much we're going to have to pay as a wage this year versus next year versus the next year. And so whenever a new plan comes out that says by 2017, maybe it'll go up to 10-10, businesses are saying, what's the rules?
Okay. You know? Well, but let's give them some certainty. Let's enact the minimum wage changes that I've called for in the next week or two. I mean, there's a good argument. So, there doesn't appear to be any job loss as a result of the minimum wage having gone up 45 cents this past January 1st. And the difference for next January 1st is whether it's going to be 30 cents or 45 cents. I don't think that's a lot of uncertainty, with all due respect, John. And so I think that I'm an advocate for people who work 40 hours a week not being in poverty. That's what I'm an advocate for.
We want to take some phone calls for Governor Malloy here, 860-275-7266. There's a lot of things that he talked about in the State of the State address that we want to get to. We also want to hear from Thomas, who's calling from Granby. Thomas, go ahead. You're on Where We Live.
Good morning, John. Good morning, Governor.
Good morning.
I just wanted to call quickly to ask, under the assumption that you will be running, which, of course, is still hypothetical at this point, but Governor Patrick up in Massachusetts spent a lot of time in his second term prioritizing transportation investment. And that's something that hasn't necessarily been at the center of discussion, at least in the past couple of years in Connecticut. There are several projects, including the extension of the Danbury line up to Massachusetts, that Massachusetts has dedicated, I think, $130 million to modernizing, which would go through Litchfield County, as well as a rail line from New London to somewhere in Massachusetts that would stop in various cities in the eastern part of the state. Mm-hmm. And there are a lot of people who are really, you know, in this age of $3, potentially $4 gasoline around the corner, wanting to see the state invest in, transportation alternatives. And I know it's incredibly expensive, but I'm just wondering what your priorities are going forwards in terms of, you know, better connecting, not only modernizing the Metro North system, which is...
Hey, and Thomas, I'm just going to break in and let the governor respond quickly, because we're going to have to take a break in a moment. And thank you for your phone call. Go ahead.
Well, listen, first of all, I think we're going to have $5 a gallon of gasoline at least 18, 22 months out. If you look at when China gets rid of its sluggishness, I think that oil prices will go up again. Now, we're on the better side of that, because we're now producing in North America as much energy as we can, as we need to use. But I think you're going to see higher prices. I think the other thing is that we are making massive investments in infrastructure. For instance, the busway is a big project. Modernization of the New Haven to a Springfield line, Hartford and Springfield, is well underway. We're spending hundreds of millions of dollars to upgrade that line. The line that you're talking about that might serve the eastern portion of the state, I'm fully supportive. That line's operational, by the way. It's just a matter of making some improvements and getting commutation on it, as opposed to simply freight. The Danbury, above Danbury line, that's a harder issue. It's going to be extremely expensive, and I'm looking at data about it and trying to ascertain how much usage that would get, and what the how much money you would have to pay, how much money the government would have to subsidize ticket wise on a long term basis to make it make any sense at all.
How about the performance of Metro North so
abysmal.
Far in this year?
I mean, well, it's abysmal. I mean, they've just had a disastrous year. I will be sitting down in the coming days with the new president, who's been brought in from Florida, where by all reports he's done an outstanding job turning around some operations down there. He has Connecticut roots, which I feel good about. So I look forward to a better performance on Metro North's part. But you couldn't have had a worse year.
So how can you, aside from sitting down with him, how can you pressure them, given the fact that they're the only game in town, to do better, to just make sure they're more on time, that they're safer, that people can feel more confident in this being the best rail system, given that it's the most crowded rail system in the entire country?
Well, they're not the only game in town. Amtrak is a player, and for instance, they actually provide the service on Shoreline East, for instance. Boston just went out and got bids, and actually for the operation of their system, and came up with a different bidder than the one that they had been using, a different purveyor. It is complicated because so many of these trains cross into New York, but we'll look at all of our options, including all of the pressure points that we can apply. And quite frankly, there's always resort to court. But I don't want to get to that. I'd rather see them do the things that they need to do and get those things done. You know, we're in the midst of a major energy overhaul on our portion of the line down in Greenwich, and things are going smooth. But that's because we did the right planning. In fact, we had triple redundancy set up before we started to mess around with how we were feeding electricity in the catenary system. So that's the kind of thing that Metro North is going to have to move to. And I've actually called for them in any major project to have it independently reviewed because, quite frankly, they're not getting it.
And so you'd consider putting this out to bid as others have done?
Yeah, I think that, you know, we're going to have to make that decision with respect to the New Haven to Springfield line relatively shortly. And I think we're more inclined to put it out to bid, not to give it to Amtrak automatically, not to give it to Metro North automatically, but to go out to the marketplace and just say who wants to operate this line and what are you going to do to prove that this is going to be run well.
Governor Daniel Malloy is our guest. He's going to take some more of your questions about all things about the budget having to do with education as well at 860-275-7266. When we come back from this break, you can also email us where we live at WNPR.org, or if you're on Twitter, tweet us at where we live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Today it's a regular visit with Governor Daniel Malloy, taking your calls and questions at 860-275-7266. Let's get to the phones. Jim's in Ledyard. Hi, Jim. Go ahead.
Hi, Governor. Thank you very much. I'm wondering, you mentioned that $11 billion savings over a period of time. And I'm wondering how much of that is at the expense of the local towns. Having been a counselor in Ledyard and the chair of the finance committee, I know that we're not seeing the same surpluses that you're seeing at the state level. And I know that our funding has been an issue, for instance, educational funding over time. So I believe it's not right to say we've had this prosperity when it's at this really on the backs of the towns and on the taxpayers.
Now, you really are kidding me here, right? I mean, you understand that when I became governor, we had a $3.6 billion deficit, including a $270 million underfunding of the ECS formula. And I held not only did I hold harmless communities from a loss, we actually put more money into the ECS formula. And I've done that every year I've been governor, as opposed to Wisconsin, as opposed to Michigan, as opposed to New Jersey, as opposed to New York. We're putting a lot more money into education and sending it to local governments. And in fact, what I'm trying to do is make sure that that's the main body of government in many ways that we're supporting, because we simply have to do a better job in preparing our young people for the future. So let's answer your question. None of that $11.6 billion reduction in overall debt is hanging over has become a part of our overall savings as a result of cutting back on local government. In point of fact, what we've done is we've begun properly funding our pensions. We've changed our relationship on a negotiated basis with employees. Employees will be working longer. We're no longer incentivizing people to retire early. Everyone will be contributing to their other post-employment benefit program. This secures those benefits. benefits for the employees by having reached those discussions and those agreements voluntarily, I might add. But that's also part of where we produce some of the very extensive savings. I mean, $11.6 billion is a lot of money. $3.6 billion deficit, which I inherited, with no money in the rainy day fund. I mean, there's a line in my speech of last week where I talk about the approved the 2009 budget, approved borrowing of $2 billion. Spend every dollar in the rainy day fund, $1.4 billion, and it still led to, when I became governor, a $3.6 billion deficit with no money in the bank. As well, by the way, let me point out that they didn't fund the pension plans by $300 million between that year and the year I became governor.
Well, one of the things, though, that you've said consistently is, I mean, you did get stuck with this big bill, and a lot of that was because of tricks and gimmicks and people pushing money ahead to leave a deficit for you. But in order to get these numbers down, you've canceled debt payments. You've put money on a credit card. You've borrowed to give aid to towns like Ledyard. These are all things that we've done that the OFA says we're going to have a billion-dollar deficit starting next year. We're going to end up with another deficit coming up right after the election.
Yeah, and so let's take that on. First of all, a lot of what you said is not correct. We haven't done those things, or where we've done them in a way to get substantially away from the long-term practices. The first thing I did as governor is put generally accepted accounting principles into place. And no one can point to our reporting as not being compliant with generally accepted accounting principles, period. That's the end of that story, quite frankly. For instance, there were gigantic raids on the transportation front. Did we end all of that at once? The answer is no. Will we end it by next year? The answer is yes. Am I 100% pure? Well, I have pure in my intentions because we're getting to that target after years of, quite frankly, raiding
fund. But you have taken money from the transportation fund.
On a declining basis to zero next year. That's the reality, John. I mean, you know, let's try to tell the whole story here. So let's go back to some other things. There was a generally accounting principle debt, which was hidden by prior administrations. We revealed it, and in point of fact, we're dealing with it on a programmatic basis to get that down to $0. That's a debt we owe ourselves, by the way. It's not a debt we owe someone else. It's a debt we owe ourselves, and was causing cash balance problems. We've addressed that, but you had to address it if you were going to go to GAAP and not have a cash balance basis problem. So I didn't create that problem. My predecessors created that problem. So, you know, you get hired to straighten things out. I think we're doing a pretty good job. So let me point out to you how good a job we're doing. We went from $3.6 billion deficit to a $500 million surplus. We went from $0 in the rainy day fund to a $500 million in the rainy day fund under the budget proposal I've made. We went from not funding our pensions to expediting the funding of our pensions, and those three things have led to, as well, a reduction on overall debt by $11.6 billion.
But the $500 million surplus you're talking about isn't apples to apples with the $3.6 billion deficit that you were given. Jody Rell came out of office with running a surplus in her last year, but then pushed ahead billions of dollars of debt for you to have to deal with. The Office of Fiscal Analysis says that there's going to be $1 billion deficit coming up next year. There's not really a $500 million surplus that we're going to see in future years.
Let's deal with that one, because I think that there's a reality. First of all, their statistics are based on data that's not current. Okay. We've seen substantially better returns over the last few months than they built that budget on. I've been governor. My average increase on a year-to-year basis is less than 2.8%. To get to their number, we would have to go crazy spending.
You're spending less than they're assuming that you'd be spending, essentially.
And by the way, we should spend less than they're assuming we're going to spend. So they come with a bloated budget and say, here's a big bloated budget. And you should and if you spent money this way, you won't have enough money. I agree. We shouldn't have a bloated budget. In fact, my budget increases are a fraction of what the average has been over the last 20 years, substantially less by, 2 percentage points out of a total. You know, we're 2.8. I think the last governor was 4.7. I don't have that exact number, but I can get it for you, John. So, yeah, we shouldn't do that. We absolutely should not spend on a bloated basis.
And we're going to get to some phone calls in just a moment. So in order to get to the numbers that we're talking about now, how much money have we had to borrow that we will be paying interest on down the road?
You know, I could get to that number very little. First of all, let's remember, when we borrow money, we pay it back on an expedited basis, much sooner than, say, a mortgage. That's number one. So our average debt is about 9.5, 10 years. So I'll give you a for instance. The prior administration borrowed $1 billion on Wall Street. Guess who had to pay back nearly 42% of that? Just guess which governor had to pay that bill for those behaviors that didn't – and because they engaged in those behaviors, didn't make the kinds of changes that I needed to make. We had to do that under my administration. So we've paid a very substantial portion of that $1 billion back, and yet we still – have a surplus. And, you know, I want to go back to your application. We absolutely have a surplus this year. I mean, this idea that's been created that we don't doesn't make any sense. If we didn't have a surplus, I couldn't be calling for returning a portion of it to the public, which we call for, paying an extra $100 million to reduce our unfunded pension obligation and other tax changes that we want to make, as well as restoring the rainy day fund to $500 million. Let's just focus on that one. $0 in the rainy day fund the day I was sworn in. By this July 1st, $500 million in the rainy day fund.
Yeah. And quickly, before we get to a phone call here, this rebate we were talking about, giving a little bit something back. I mean, you in your speech even say, you know, this isn't going to make a huge difference in people's lives. To some people, it may very well be some money in their pocket, which will be very helpful. To others, they say, can't we spend our money better than just giving out $55 to everyone in the state? Tell me a bit about the thought process in doing this, given some of the debt obligations we have, the fact that we do want to put money in the rainy day fund, that we have so many other things we want to invest in. Why this particular rebate right now?
Because it's the right thing to do. People have been called upon to make sacrifices, and they've made them. And we are specifically refunding a portion of sales tax and gas taxes. That's what we're doing. And we're laying the tracks for eliminating or actually restoring the clothing allowance of $50. These are all important things. We shouldn't be about building an ever bloated government. You know, and again, I want to go back to your reference to outstanding debt. Do me a favor, John, at least when I'm around, say, hey, we have debt, but you've reduced it by $11.6 billion. By the way, John, point to another governor who's done that as a total percentage overall debt.
But one of the things I guess I want to get to is if you look at apples to apples comparisons, for instance, on this budget deficit you were given, if you were handed a $3.6 billion deficit and you cut it down to what the OFA says is something like $1 billion by the time next year rolls around, that is an enormous thing. You've cut $2.6 billion in state government. You've figured out a way to save that. And I think it's making that apples to apples comparison so that everyone understands that is something that you were able to do, but it didn't magically turn into a $500 million surplus.
No, revenues are up, John. Let's
are they going to continue to rise at the level that
there's yeah. certainly reason to believe that they're going to do that. The strength of the numbers would lead you to believe that. And again, I want to go back to that to where we were, John. If we were spending at the rate that the prior two administrations were spending, we'd have a deficit right now. I mean, I'm in this catch-22. I get handed a tough situation. We deal with it. People are mad because we dealt with it. Now they're mad because, you know, something else is going to happen, and they'll be mad because something else is going to happen. So what I'm trying to do is say, let's look at where we are. 40,000 private sector jobs created. More money going into education than at any time in our history, including ECS funding having gone up every year that I've been governor. Tackling tough issues like mental health, tackling infrastructure issues across the board, sending more money back to local governments. And yet we're still going to be able to have $500 million in our rainy day fund. We're going to have a much better funded pension obligation. We're going to be in a position to lower taxes. That's a pretty good 3 years of work.
We're talking with Governor Daniel Malloy here. You can join us at 860-275-7266. Miles is calling from the University of Connecticut. Hello, Miles.
Hi.
Hi, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Great. So, Governor, I'm a sophomore at UConn, and last week in your State Address, you mentioned college affordability. So
yes.
I'm just wondering if you could explain how you'll be working to address that issue.
Sure. Thank you. A couple of things. Number one, long-term, I'm calling for the establishment of the Baby Scholars Program under the CHET program, where from this year forward, any child who's born or adopted in the state of Connecticut, $100 would be available from state government to start their savings plan. And as soon as the parents had contributed their own $150, we would contribute another $150. Long-term planning, encouraging good habits, having college savings ready when you go away to college. With respect to a sophomore, we're putting more money into the Governor's Scholarship Program. It'll have a total funding in excess of $45 million this year. Thousands and thousands of students will access some portion of those funds to pay for their education in Connecticut this year. With respect to the region system, which is the four Southern, Central, Eastern, Western 12 community colleges are online college. I'm working with them to make sure that any increase in their cost will be at a minimum. And specifically, we're shifting additional dollars to fund that, as well as fund remediation programs, as well as to make sure that they have the money necessary to begin the upgrade of that system with a very substantial down payment of $134 million in total expenditures. So those are three things that we're doing around the issue of college affordability. More scholarships, long-term, long-ball planning, and more money to support that particular system. You're at the UConn system. Quite frankly, we've done a lot at the UConn system over the last couple of years, and I'm just happy to have a region's plan that we can work with, and I look forward to funding it on a long – seeing it funded on a long-term basis.
Yeah, I think the folks at the CSU system are very happy to hear that. Just to get back to that Baby Scholars Program, which is intriguing, this idea of incentivizing good behavior, saving for a college future, just explain exactly how that works. Do you set up a fund for each and every person who has a child? If someone already has college savings funds set up, does the money get distributed into that fund? How exactly is that going to work?
The system will be overseen by the state treasurer. We actually have exceptional returns in that particular fund. And so any child who's born in Connecticut or adopted in Connecticut from the effective date forward will be entitled to $100 to go into that fund. Now, there's some paperwork. The parents have to fill out some paperwork, or we have to figure out how to get that done automatically, one way or the other. The second reward is when the parents have set aside an additional $150 of their own money. That's when we put an additional $150. So our total contribution to that early education fund from day one could be as high as $250. I think it's a great program. I think it's going to allow will it pay for anyone's education in and of itself? Certainly not $250 will, but good behaviors will go a long way.
I think the incentivization for people to do that makes a lot of sense. Did you see this thing that the Tennessee Governor Bill Haslam came out with in his State of the State address? He's urging a plan. He's Republican. He's urging his legislature to adopt a plan for two free years of community college and technical school. He says this plan in his state is going to cost about $34 million a year. And the cost of a college education, at least at the community college level, is about commensurate in Tennessee with the national level, maybe a bit higher here in Connecticut. What do you think about an idea like that?
I love it. We're taking steps in that direction, quite frankly. In my speech, we roll out and speak about a program that would allow students to graduate from high school with 2 years of work in community college, actually an associate's degree. Now, that would require that student to work, you know, to go to school perhaps over the summer and take some swing semesters and that sort of thing. But we want to build those kinds of programs. Absolutely. One of the things that we also proposed in the address, and I think is going to help us. I point out in the address that 113,000 people in the state of Connecticut have started college and not completed it.
Mm-hmm.
And I call this a debt they owe themselves. So what we're saying is if you've been out of school for more than 18 months and you come back to the Connecticut system or take courses in the Connecticut system, as long as you actually matriculate, we'll match one free course for every course you take up to three free courses. Really try to incentivize people to get back into the community colleges. So those are ideas are all kinds of – those are the kinds of ideas that I think we need to move forward with and move forward with on a rapid basis.
As we're talking about education, let's go to Mary Ann, who is calling from Guilford. Let's see if I can get this working. Mary Ann, hello. You're on Where We Live.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Governor, I would like to applaud you for taking a step back on teacher evaluations and on creating the Common Core Task Force. I think it shows flexibility and a responsiveness at state government that sometimes is rare.
Yeah, well, I'm trying to work with everybody on this. For instance, earlier this year, you know.
Actually, hang on. It's not my question.
Okay.
My question is, I don't know if you're aware that thousands of Connecticut's 11th graders are being required to take a field test this year, even though they took the CAP test last year. The Smarter Balanced Field Test doesn't evaluate student performance, and no results will be available. And according to your Office of Education, there is no benefit to our 11th graders that they will be missing 8 or more hours of class time to take the test.
Yeah. You know,
8 to 10 hours of instructional time, no benefit, at a cost of $27.30 per student to the state. And there are additional costs at the local level with adding equipment, Wi-Fi capability, and the state is asking us to take away time from student learning during what is arguably the most important year of their high school career, particularly for students who are college-bound.
Jim.
So it puts them at a disadvantage, and I'd like to hear your comments.
Sure.
Thank you, Mary.
So I'll go back to – I'll answer that, and I'll go back to what I started to say, and that is that a number of our school districts would have been required to give two tests. And earlier this year, I asked for permission in Washington to limit that to one test, and then we allowed the communities to choose which test they would participate in. So with respect to the program that you're talking about, I'll take another look at that. The reality is we've got to get to a test that measures in accordance with the Common Core, which is coming at us. We know that. And quite frankly, I think it's overwhelmingly supported, and I think teachers are overwhelmingly supported. So developing a test may require some sacrifices, although you've laid it out in a way that I'm not sure I was fully aware of. So I'll go back and take a look at it.
Last week, I had Stephen Pryor, Education Commissioner.
I listened to him about the first half of the show.
Yeah. And he had a really good panel. We had some representatives from state teachers unions. We had a very successful superintendent from Wallingford, and we had the commissioner. And one of the first things I asked him was about this change to the plans around the Common Core, the rollout of these new Common Core standards at the same time as the teacher evaluation was something that he said probably wasn't done the way it should have been done. I asked him what changed between when this got rolled out and a whole bunch of teachers said this isn't going to work, and now when it seems to have not worked. What changed in your mind over this time?
Sure. Well, one of the things is that with respect to test, we gave all of the districts a choice. You choose which test you want to give. 70% of the districts chose the Common Core test, which means that we're not going to have the kind of data that you want to use for comparative purposes. So, A, allowing districts to go to one test, not two, and then having sufficient year-to-year data to look at seems to make a lot of sense. So, actually, in accommodating one change, it almost dictated that we make another change. I wouldn't require districts to have two different tests. I wouldn't go back to that. That well over a third of districts would have had to have both tests. So you talk about an 11th grader losing some hours. Magnify that by two. So for certain classes. So, you know, what this is about reflecting reality. And if you're going to use tests as a barometer, then you have to have consistent and comparative data. Simple as that. I mean, really, John, it's not rocket science. It's working with folks to get to the right place. So I'll go back to one of the things that was in the legislation and inserted in the legislation at the end of when we were working on education reform was that the NEAG school at UConn would evaluate the 10 districts who looked at this, or actually who spearheaded the drive. Yeah. They came back reporting that overwhelming. When everything was said and done, it had pretty strong support amongst teachers at the end, and not a lot of support or understanding at the beginning. That's the data. So let's take some time and let's get it right. I think the reality is that we're already seeing improvements in education in Connecticut. For instance, we saw a 1.8% increase in the graduation rate this past year. Now 1.8% doesn't sound like a lot. But that's a large increase in a single back-to-back comparison. So we are, in fact, seeing changes. We're seeing great experimentation. Schools that are going to longer school days. Meriden, a great program, which I've visited on a number of occasions, has extended in cooperation with teachers. Not every teacher works the extended day. It's done on a volunteer basis. But every kid in some of these schools is getting an additional hour and a half of school. A common experience at breakfast. breakfast, a common physical experience, a common educational experience before the normal school day starts. That school had the kind of turnaround numbers that were really quite exceptional. So what we're trying to do is get everybody out of the box and work with everybody at the same time. And so it makes sense to go back, make appropriate adjustments, sit down with representatives of teachers, of superintendents, of everyone else. In the peak process, they're all represented. In fact, the peak process, which is the folks who oversee this, there are the teachers' unions, the superintendents, boards of education are all represented on that body that came up with this original program. They want to change it, make some accommodations. I'm all for it.
We're talking with Governor Daniel Malloy. If you have more questions about education, we'll take more of those. More about the budget or some of the things he plans to roll out this year, as he talked about in the State of the State address last year, you can call us at 860-275-7266. We have to take a break. When we come back, we will also take your tweets at Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up on tomorrow's show, for 100 years, Connecticut's made itself home to a large and diverse system of state parks and forests. We'll be exploring the history of our state parks and forests and talk about some of the efforts being made to preserve them. If you love our state parks, give us a call tomorrow on the program. You can always follow along at WNPR.org. As a matter of fact, you can continue this conversation that we're having today with Governor Daniel Malloy online at WNPR.org. You can also email your questions to us, wherewelive@WNPR. We're getting a lot of people who want to get in touch with us, and there's just about 10 minutes left. So let me read you first a tweet from Urban Policy. It says, isn't it contradictory to say budget is increasing at the slowest rate, but towns and taxpayers are held harmless?
No, it's not. It's not inconsistent. We have held towns harmless, and in many cases, towns and communities have seen substantial increases. It's about setting priorities. And that's something that Connecticut just didn't do for a long period of time. Education is a high priority, and supportive education means more dollars going to local governments. So it's not inconsistent. What's inconsistent is to spend more money than you have on an ongoing basis that builds up long-term structural deficits, and I'm not for that. So I'm sending as much money as we can reasonably get out to local communities. In fact, we actually increased another funding item to offset the taxes not received by local communities for colleges and hospitals. We put another $8 or $9 million into that fund. That's going back to local communities that have a hospital or a college facility in their midst. No, it's not inconsistent at all.
I want to get to Stuart in Farmington. Hi, Stuart.
Hi, Governor.
Hello.
Hi. Listen, first, you're to be commended for the initiative you took when you came into office to restore the health of the state employees' retirement fund. Just, can you tell us where we are with that now, what the plan is going forward, and is it realistic to give a projected date when it would be fully restored to full funding?
Yeah, no, we are. I memorize a lot of stuff, and I can give that to you because it's on a chart. I think it's on our website. We will get to 100% funding well within the 20-year period of time. I think we get to about 85, maybe in year 14 or 15. That's because we are putting more money into that obligation to defease it. So let me give you a statistic. I've called for putting $100 million of additional money on top of our now properly actuarially adjusted contributions. That $100 million actually means $430 million in return, so because it's invested. So by putting $100 million in, for valuation purposes, we have a value of $430 million. It really is quite exceptional. And that's why for the years before I became governor, not putting $300 million into the pension plans had the same negative effect. You know, for each $100 million, it was as if you took $430 million out of the fund. So you're talking about well in excess of $1 billion that was effectively withdrawn from that fund by not making those deposits.
Let's go to Alexander in Guilford. Hi, Alexander. Go ahead.
Hi there. I'm actually a Common Core standards fan, and I'm hopeful about the Common Core assessments. But I've got a question about the timing of the rollout. That is, how many years of catch-up is appropriate to get kids who have not been taught to Common Core state standards in order to fairly assess them by a new Common Core test? For example, today's third graders have had a couple years of non-Common Core and maybe a year or two of Common Core aligned teaching. And so are they going to be ready for Common Core tests in grade 4? All right, so if that's true, then what about today's seventh graders? Do they need more years of catch-up in a Common Core world before they and their teachers are going to be assessed based on grade-level Common Core line tests?
Well, I think there's two questions there, and I think all of your points are very good. First of all, Common Core was adopted in Connecticut in 2009, so well before I became governor, and I think it was the right thing to do, by the way. Certain districts are way out in front of this. And other districts have not done the early work. That's a reality. But the test is coming. The Common Core is the new requirement. So let me answer the data portion of it. For comparative purposes, you need at least two, perhaps 3 years of data so that you can measure strength and weakness on a year-to-year basis. So the simple answer is it becomes more important, let's say, 2 or 3 years into that testing than it is or more valid, I suppose would be the better way to say that, than simply looking at a test score and not having a comparable test to compare it to. So those are two separate issues. Again, I don't know what district you're in. Certain districts have been teaching to the Common Core from 2010 on. So they're way ahead of folks, and in a state where you have 160 plus districts, that's going to happen. Is it a good thing it happened? No, but local governments make decisions about education policy and when to implement those kinds of changes, at least within a framework.
We just have a couple minutes left. I wanted to ask you about proposals for veterans issues. You talked about a specific allocation of $500,000 for a review of state facilities. We've heard about some VA places in Rocky Hill maybe sitting empty, not being used to their fullest. What can you tell us about this review of state facilities for veterans?
We are, in some senses, we're already doing it. What I've said is I'm pledging, and I think our state has to pledge, to end homelessness for veterans by the end of 2015. And to do that, we need to designate different types of housing. Now, there are veterans who have no problems at all, except they don't make enough money for housing. Goes back to my minimum wage, by the way. Finding them housing is easier than folks who need congregate type delivery of congregate services. So what we need to do is look at our facilities. What could be made available more quickly than others? Some houses in Rocky Hill obviously should be filled, but who fills them? Is that transition back to community or is that first time housing? Other facilities at Rocky Hill, should we put more money into some of those and put those back into what I would call production or housing production or not? There are facilities in other parts of the state that the state owns that could be easily converted for that purpose. And should we set up a different type of program, which would be the equivalent of a Section 8 type program for veterans? All of that needs a very quick look, but I'm committed to getting this done.
So when we hear that there's some money that's already been spent on housing in Rocky Hill that's not being used, that's part of this review, and you hope to have that used in some productive way to help veterans.
Yeah, and in point of fact, I think that's probably a best transitional back type housing. It's certainly far more independent than living on the campus. I think this housing got planned for and built by a prior administration without a plan on how to use it. And I think there was some foot dragging. So I was aware of that. I've told them to get ready to fill that housing. So listen, we got a veteran who comes to Rocky Hill. He's unemployed. Perhaps he's suffering from depression or anxiety or some other condition. We want to get him healthy. We want to get him a job. We want to transition him back to his family or to back to the community from that he came from. So using that housing for that purposes, which has a different level of independence than living on the campus, seems to be the best possible use of that housing.
We just have a minute left, and I suppose I'll get back to where I started here. I asked you if you were running for re-election, and I know that you've said that time will come. Could you give us any sort of a time frame about when you might be making an announcement like this? Only because as you roll out these, and some of them, as you say, are long-term objectives, I think it's important for state residents to know whether or not they've got a governor who's in it long-term with them or not.
I don't think anyone in the state of Connecticut, the people who like me and people who hate me, think I'm not in it for the long long haul. Listen, I signed up for this job knowing how bad things were going to be. I'm trying to spend as much time of my time not talking about politics as possible. The Republicans have a Donnybrook on their hands. Let them go at each other. Let them have some fun. Let them throw some elbows at one another. I'm sure they'll throw some my direction. I'm in no hurry at all, John. I just don't want to talk about politics. I want to talk about good government. I want to talk about more job creation. I want to talk about lessening the state's overall obligations, getting the fiscal house in order, and complying with GAAP. Those are all the kinds of things that I want to talk about, and I'm going to.
And luckily, we had an opportunity during this hour to talk about just about all of those things. Thank you once again, Governor
Thanks.
Malloy, for coming in.
Thank you.
Of course, as always, you can continue this conversation online. Go to WNPR.org. Our program is produced by Lydia Brown and Tucker Ives. The executive producer is Katie Talarski. I'm John Dankosky. This is Where We Live.